Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Homesickness today is dismissed as a sign of immaturity. It's what children feel at summer camp. But in the 19th century, it was recognized as a powerful emotion. When gold miners in California heard the tune Home Sweet Home, they sobbed. When Civil War soldiers became homesick, Army doctors sent them home lest they die. Such images don't fit with our national mythology, which celebrates the restless individualism of immigrants and supposedly left home and never looked back. Susan Matt, who is a Weber State University professor, a chair of the history department there, author of Homesickness in American History, says that iconic symbols of the undaunted, forward-looking American spirit were often homesick, hesitant, reluctant voyagers. And even today, in a global society that prizes movement, that condemns homesickness as a childish emotion, colleges counsel young adults and their families on how to manage the transition away from home. Suburbanites pine for their old neighborhoods, and companies take seriously the emotional toll borne by relocated executives and road warriors. By highlighting how Americans have reacted to moving farther and farther from their roots, Susan Matt revises long-held assumptions about home, mobility, and our national identity. Susan Matt joins us by the telephone. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming on with us. I'm curious how you got into this subject. What provoked this?
Well, I'm a historian of emotions, which is a small subfield, and I study the emotions that I guess I experience most and which I wonder about. And when I moved out to Utah in 1999 with my husband, we had been very eager to move west. But once I got here, I began to long a bit for my family in Chicago and began to wonder if I was the only person who had ever felt some sadness about leaving home. I had grown up hearing that it was absolutely normal to move on and pull up stakes and relocate, and nobody had ever told me there was a sad side to it. So I wondered if I was a freak or if there was something larger going on in American culture, and I was happy to find out that I was not alone.
It goes against our national myth, doesn't it? As you say in the book, we're rugged individualists. We move on and we don't look back.
That's exactly the stories I'd been raised on, of settlers heading west in wagons, and you never see them looking over their shoulders in the movies, and gold miners heading to California. There's never a sense in the mythologies we've created that this was a painful process, and so I was absolutely surprised when I found it painful. Even when I was going someplace I really wanted to, it wasn't as easy as it had cracked up to be.
And not only do we not, I don't know, acknowledge this, I think we actively repress this, don't we? It's, as you say, it's dismissed as a sign of immaturity. It's what children feel at summer camp. It's not what I feel.
Yeah, exactly. And we're, as 20th and 21st century Americans, we're kind of strange in denying the feeling compared to our ancestors. Most of our ancestors, whether they were immigrants in the 17th century or immigrants in the 19th century, were pretty open that they were longing for places they'd left behind. And in fact, if you didn't feel homesickness, if you didn't feel sadness at leaving people you cared about and places you were familiar with behind, there was something wrong with you. It's only in the 20th century we've kind of pathologized the emotion and infantilized it, making it a kid's emotion. It was something grown men would readily acknowledge in the 19th century.
As we go along here, I want to trace that evolution, and I'll ask you why. I wonder if you could, if you have your book with you, page the first paragraph in your introduction. This will illustrate the differences between then and now.
Sure. It opens with this anecdote. In 1887, 42-year-old Reverend Father J.M. McHale left Ireland to take up a position in a Brooklyn parish. Shortly after arriving in New York, he became afflicted with nostalgia and began to waste away. Newspaper accounts reported that McHale proclaimed, "I cannot eat. My heart is breaking." In his troubled sleep, he talked of Ireland and his friends there. He often murmured, "I am homesick. My dear country, I will never set foot on your green shores again. Oh, my mother, how I long to see you." He eventually lost consciousness and died. His death was attributed to homesickness, or nostalgia, as it was then called. And this was not an unusual diagnosis in 19th century America, nor was newspaper coverage of McHale's death. Papers sometimes reprinted the pathos-filled letters of migrants separated from their loved ones, and sometimes carried news of their sorrowful death.
So here's a man who died of homesickness.
Yeah, and that's remarkably common from the 17th century to the early 20th century. Newspapers, medical journals, diaries are all filled with accounts of people dying of homesickness, which from the 17th century on was called nostalgia. That word was coined by a Swiss doctor who wanted to describe acute homesickness that could cause physical illness, and it became a medical diagnosis that was used into the 20th century by American doctors. And Reverend McHale was one of the people to fall victim to it. People really thought it was a medical condition.
Now, in the Civil War, you write that the doctors were very concerned about this. You could be sent home for homesickness.
Exactly. There was a national awareness of the problem, and all over 5,200 Union soldiers were diagnosed with nostalgia acute enough to have medical symptoms, and 72 Union soldiers died of the condition. It's really interesting to go back to the Surgeon General's records and see deaths caused by a variety of diseases, and there's nostalgia listed as one of them. So people were eager to reduce the number of deaths due to nostalgia and to avoid condemning soldiers to this painful suffering. Often Army commanders would send acutely homesick boys home. That was really the only known cure for the disease. There were other interesting things during the Civil War. Sometimes Army bands were forbidden from playing the most popular song in America, Home Sweet Home, because the fear was it would render soldiers melancholic and then they'd gradually waste away.
Wow. This seems so foreign to us, doesn't it, in today's day? I wonder, I'd like to compare and contrast this. And you, soon after you, in the book, you tell the story of the death of Reverend McHale. You quote New York Times writer Catherine Lanfer. Tell me that story.
Yeah, Catherine Lanfer was a writer who moved from Minnesota to Manhattan, actually, to write for the Al Franken show. In 2004, she talked about the experience of moving from the Midwest to the East Coast. She said, "My first week ended with a sharp bout of homesickness. To cheer herself up, she decided to get a manicure, and she told the Korean woman who was doing her hands, 'I'm pretty homesick,' but she did not encounter much sympathy from the manicurist, who was herself far from home. The manicurist looked at Lamfer with impatience. According to Lamfer, her eyes narrowed, she sucked in some breath, and then she barked out an uppercase admonition, 'Don't be big baby.'" It's a modern attitude towards homesickness.
Yeah. And that is the modern attitude, isn't it? Don't be a big baby.
Yeah, you're supposed to get over it. I mean, that's why we send kids to camp, and that's why if you're not over it by camp, then you're over it by college. At least that's the theory. But I think it's more that people learn that while they still can feel the emotions, it's not proper to talk about them.
So then what? It seems so foreign to us then. We learn about Reverend McHale dying of homesickness and Civil War doctors taking this condition very seriously enough to send needed soldiers home, lest they die. So what was going on there? I guess from our vantage point, we could see this as, I don't know, mass hysteria or something.
Yeah, I think it was depression. What we would call depression, and depression itself is a newly created category that only occurs in the 1920s, but we would call it depression. And often in the Civil War, people said it was a condition that would latch on to other conditions. So if you had dysentery and then you got nostalgia, the two combined would be particularly fatal. So it would weaken you, and then you might be more susceptible to other diseases as well. And there were whole debates about whether it alone caused death or if it worked in combination with other illnesses. But people were very sincere in believing that it could be a fatal condition. And I guess I take them seriously. We keep changing our terms for psychological and physical diseases. I don't think in 100 years all the terms we have today will be believed as credible either. So,
yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, what will people pick out from what we consider to be, I guess, you know, normal?
Yeah, I mean, ADHD didn't exist before. I mean, it may have existed, but we didn't have a category for it until the 20th century. There are all these conditions that exist in societies but get named, relabeled, recategorized, and homesickness was certainly one of those.
It makes me wonder, you know, in 100 years, people looking back at our times and calling us big babies for something, you know.
Yeah, I can't quite imagine which of our many complexes will be called big babies for, but I'm sure we will.
That's right. I guess one generation judging another. You say in your introduction that you quote Gene Starobinsky. Is that how the first historian to critically study homesickness? So, of course, always individuals longed for home, but the invention of names for this came around, what, colonial period?
Yeah, it actually happens first in Europe. In 1688, this Swiss doctor, Johannes Hofer, comes up with the name nostalgia, and he uses Greek words to make it sound like it's this ancient disease, but the word doesn't exist before 1688. And he describes in a medical journal a case of a young man who lived in Bern, Switzerland, and went to Basel, which was about 60 miles away, and began to get ill, so ill he was going to die. And then his friends put him on a hospital litter and carry him across the mountains. And as he gets closer and closer to home, he revives. And he gave some other cases of young people similarly at death's door. And his dissertation on nostalgia, published in 1688, started a trend across Europe, which eventually spread to America, of people using this category, nostalgia, to diagnose illness. The word homesickness soon followed. It did not exist in English until the 1750s. And probably crossed over to America shortly thereafter. It got put in wide use pretty quickly because there were lots of people far from home in the Americas who found that word very relevant to their feelings.
So for a lot of history, people weren't all that mobile. So, you know, it kind of strikes me, it's very striking to me that this fellow got nostalgia by traveling from Bern to Basel, right? That's not very far, but it was far to him.
Yeah, it was 60 miles, and that could seem like, you know, 6 days' journey maybe. So it was a great deal farther than he'd been. And even in America in the 19th century, a lot of people have never been more than 20 miles from their house at the start of the century. So how far things were was relative, and people were, even if they moved, didn't move as far or as often as Americans became accustomed to. Lots of people who start moving in America talk about how unnatural it is. It just doesn't seem right to move from your parents or your house and leave that behind. And ministers would preach against it as defying God's law. So there was a lot of opposition to mobility in America and in Europe, and a lot of worry about what it could do to you emotionally, physically, and morally.
So even in America, which that of course became, I think, quickly part of our national ethos, right? It's restlessness that de Tocqueville, he mentions this.
That, you know, Americans will build a house and move before the roof is on.
Yeah.
That's the image I always read about in college and grad school. There were just a few things that sort of peeked out at me that made me think maybe that wasn't the truth, or the whole truth anyhow. There was a lot of regretful backward glances. And what surprised me was how early this started in America. Even the first settlers in America were eager to go home. So colonists in Virginia often tried to return home if they had the money. Even the Puritans, the Pilgrims, who we think were so dedicated to the religious cause and the religious communities they were founding here, probably 1 in 6 went home, and a far larger number wanted to but couldn't afford to. But again, that's kind of left out of our story because we like to think of America as a magnet that attracts people. And the reality is this was a place a lot of people thought they'd try out and then go back home after perhaps making a profit here. That was the goal of a lot of people who initially settled, whether they were coming in the 1600s or the present day. That's a common sort of goal and plan for the journey to America. It's not going to be forever. Often it turns out to be a permanent new home, but most people intend to go home when they come here.
We'll take a break. We'll come back with Susan Matt, who is the chair of the history department at Weber State University. She is presidential distinguished professor of history at Weber State. And she's author of Homesickness, An American History. That's what we're talking about today. Also author of Keeping Up with the Joneses, Envy, an American Consumer Society, and other works. And we'll talk, we'll bring it forward as we go along to today. And Susan Matt just made reference to this essential feature of globalization and the fact that I think we still have this idea that we, since we can travel and since we can go somewhere else and make a better life for our family back home, that perhaps there isn't that emotional cost, or at least we downplay that quite a bit. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about people who actually did go home and found, well, home has moved on as well. More following the break.
Traveling shoes, Lord, got on my traveling shoes. Traveling shoes, Lord, got on my traveling shoes.
Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, and six other significant African-American women will come to life during Traveling Shoes, a one-woman show presented by Utah Public Radio. Featuring professional speaker, storyteller, and writer Janice Brooks, the performance will take place at 7 p.m. Thursday, February 5th in the Kane Performance Hall on Utah State University campus. The event is part of the Provost Series on Instructional Excellence in celebration of Black History Month. There's no cost to attend Traveling Shoes. However, tickets are required and available at arts.usu.edu. More information is at upr.org and 797-3215.
Aaron Perdue grew up in small-town Colorado, and his family literally went to great lengths so he could learn to play the flute.
In order to have lessons, my dad would actually drive me 3 hours one way.
Aaron Perdue is our new PT Young Artist in Residence. He'll join us for music and conversation on the next performance today from 8 p.m.
Wednesday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Homesickness today is dismissed as a sign of immaturity. It's what children feel at summer camp. But in the 19th century, it was recognized as a powerful emotion. When gold miners in California heard the tune Home Sweet Home, they sobbed. When Civil War soldiers became homesick, Army doctors sent them home lest they die. Such images don't, of course, fit with our national mythology, which celebrates the restless individualism of immigrants who supposedly left home and never looked back. That, of course, is not true. And Susan Matt, who is Presidential Distinguished Professor of History at Weber State University, has written a book, Homesickness, An American History. She is a historian of emotions. How do you phrase it, Susan Matt? You study emotional history.
Yeah, I think you said it. I'm a historian of the emotions.
Of the emotions. Yeah.
Strange, but emotions do have a history, and they change over time.
By the way, how do you parse that out? I guess you go. People express themselves in their diaries. Where else do you go?
Diaries, letters, sometimes medical reports, psychological reports. I think you can even find emotions in gravestones and quilts and paintings. Once you start looking for them, they're ubiquitous. Sometimes you can even find them, say, in gardens. For homesickness, I was intrigued to find out that the fact that there are lilacs growing in Southern California is representative of the fact that New Englanders moving to the Southwest wanted the landscape to look familiar. So you can find emotions all around us, but you have to be on the lookout.
And this is an interesting case study, I imagine. And, you know, it's one reason why you wrote the book. There's such a big disconnect between what we're supposed to be feeling and what we're actually feeling with regard to homesickness.
Yeah, you know, one kind of transformative moment for me, I moved to Ogden in 1999, and if you know the Ogden landscape at the north end, Ben Lomond Mountain dominates the skyline, and somebody in the history department told me that it had been named by a homesick Scottish immigrant, and I thought, well, that's weird. There shouldn't have been any homesick westerning pioneers. So even the names of familiar mountains, hills, lakes often reflected where people came from. But again, in the 19th century, they would have expressed it. not just through naming mountains, but in their diaries and letters. In the 20th century and 21st century, we've become much more reticent about talking about those feelings because we worry what people think. And surveys show that today people who express the emotion or want to express it fear that they're going to be viewed negatively.
Yeah, it can be a powerful, can it? Societal pressure, family pressure. What we decide as a culture is acceptable or taboo, that can have a powerful effect on us.
Yeah, and in fact, homesickness has been called a taboo emotion today for adults. So people learn that there are other ways to channel the emotions. Maybe they'll buy foods that their mother back in India made or try to make them themselves. Maybe they'll watch television programs that now, through the wonders of satellite, they can see anywhere in the world. So there are other ways people may express their longing to be back without using words.
You're welcome to join the conversation here with Susan Matt. She's a Presidential Distinguished Professor of History at Weber State University, and her book, very interesting book, out from Oxford University Press, Homesickness and American History, is our topic for the day. The number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. You can join us by email to upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. Or you can join us on Twitter, at Utah Public Radio. Perhaps you'd like to discuss your homesickness. We'll give you permission here on the program. 1-800-826-1495. Tell us your experience migrating, or perhaps this is something passed down in your family. For example, here in the West, Susan Matt, you know, that Kentucky bluegrass that we care for so carefully, that's a sign of collective homesickness, isn't it?
Oh, I think that's a great example. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a perfect example of landscapes that ancestors remembered and tried to recreate.
So I wonder, going back to your experience, you come out from Chicago, come to Utah, and you find that you're homesick. Part of that is you're missing your immediate family, right? And part of it is, I don't know, cultural? You're missing the culture back there?
Yeah, I think the culture and just some of the, you know, daily sights of life, some of the assumptions people carry in their heads, just the way people speak. And it wasn't anything I necessarily, went through and said, I miss this and this and this. I did realize that all of a sudden in my classes, my students were learning a somewhat Chicago-centric brand of American history, where it seemed to be the center of most things. And I'm not trying to give them an inaccurate sense of American history, but I realized I talked and thought about about Chicago quite a bit with my students, with my colleagues.
And then I guess it can be charming to see the exotic aspects of your new culture, you know, fry sauce, funeral potatoes, that kind of thing. But it highlights, I suppose, for you that you're not home.
Right, and I think most people end up kind of building a hybrid identity where they embrace part of what they've left behind and embrace part of their new culture. And certainly now having been here almost 16 years, I feel much more at home here. And often when I go back to the Midwest, I'm glad I live in Utah. But at first, a lot of the things that I take for granted today seemed quite foreign.
So you've been in Utah, what, you say 19 years?
Yeah, 16, yeah.
16 years. Do you feel at home here now? What has happened over that time?
Well, I think I do feel more at home here. My husband and I intentionally came to Utah. We wanted to live in the West. We'd been talking about it all through our grad school years. We knew we liked hiking and biking and skiing, and all of those assets of Utah have we've taken advantage of. But, you know, we also made good friends. We developed a community, a sense of social bonds. And I think that what also happens is the longer you're in one place, the longer you're away from the places you've left, so that a shift happens and the relationships that are most alive are the ones you're in the midst of every day, excepting, of course, my parents who,
right.
You know, but.
So, I mean, the opposite of homesickness would be feeling at home, I suppose. And so what is that? How do you, I mean, it's family, right? That's part of it. It's culture. What else is that?
Oh, family, culture. I think people often feel the lack of food. That's something that either you're longing for or you're satisfied with, depending if you're feeling at home or homesick. I think music, language is a huge one for a lot of people. Sometimes when I was reading accounts of people who felt homesick, one thing that made them feel not at home was the way America structures its neighborhoods, particularly post-World War II, where we had kind of scattered suburban developments, not extended families, but just the nuclear family household. And if you were somebody coming from Vietnam or Cuba or Mexico, where you might have more generations in a household and more close neighbors with whom you could talk and more of an open door front porch policy than many American neighborhoods allow today, you miss that community, that sense of just always being with kin, always having a neighborhood. I don't think modern American building styles really accommodate that that style of living, which is so common throughout the rest of the world.
I want to go back and pick up some things from the colonial period. Also, a couple of very interesting case studies of slaves who were brought by force to this country. That's an interesting case study. And the Indians who were, you know, forcibly removed. There's a very interesting picture of from the Carlisle Indian School. I'll talk about that as well. But I want to bring it forward to today. So this idea that homesickness should not be emphasized, that fits very well with globalization, right? And you looked at an op-ed piece you wrote in the New York Times. But it doesn't, you know, it shouldn't mask the fact, you say, that people still feel homesick, even with technology.
Yeah, I think we've always felt that somehow we would solve the problem of homesickness, that it would resolve itself. And that at some point you would be able to overcome the fact of distance. And so we hear this all the time, whether people are selling cell phones or touting the wonders of Skype, that you can be there even if you're not there. But, you know, what I found was that people are saying the same thing about the telegraph in the 19th century. The telegraph is going to completely solve homesickness and people will never miss home again. And I think the one problem is you're still not home, even if you can see it on your computer screen or hear it on your phone. And so technology in some ways may assuage the emotion, may make you feel more connected to the places you've left behind. But some people I talked to also said that it heightened the emotion because they could see and hear everything they missed. There was a real divide in the people I interviewed who some celebrated the fact that modern technology was helping them with their sense of longing, and some felt like it only augmented it, accentuated it.
In your op-ed piece, by the way, you can go to Susan Matt's page there at Weber State University and link over. But you cite Maria Elena Rivera, psychologist in Tepic, Mexico, and she talks about her sister Carmen, who's been living in San Diego for 25 years. So now you have inexpensive long-distance calling, and so now she's phoning home every Sunday. And the family's all together back in Mexico eating the meal.
Mm-hmm.
And Carmen says this technology made it worse for her, made her more homesick.
Yeah, he used the phrase magnificar la nostalgia, magnifies the homesickness. They still use the word nostalgia in Mexico for the condition. And so she was convinced that there were some ambiguities about technology's effects on emotional life and that it wasn't all a plus, but that her sister seemed to be sadder the more with the increased contact. And so, of course, I think nobody would want to go back to a time when you had less contact, but I think that points to the fact that some of these emotional problems brought on by mobility are not going to be solved by some technological quick fix unless you can time travel or get back and forth very quickly and cheaply. And I think that's something else. Our modern our sense that we can be anywhere, we can just hop a flight or get on a train very quickly, lulls a lot of people into thinking migration is going to be easy. They've got the technology to talk. They've got the technology to travel cheaply and easily. It should be easy to come back and forth between one place and another. But in fact, for many immigrants, it ends up being much more expensive than they expected, and getting home becomes much harder. So sometimes technology may seduce us into leaving home make us underestimate just how painful it can be.
You also, in this op-ed piece, talk about Ricardo Valencia, immigrated from Guadalajara.
Yeah.
Went to Nevada so he could pay off a mortgage back home. It's a fairly typical reason, right, for coming to better economics. But he always intended to go back. In fact, on day one in Nevada, he wanted to go back home.
Yeah, and, you know, that's such a typical attitude, not just among modern immigrants, but, as I mentioned, since the 17th century. And you certainly find it among Ellis Island immigrants. Most historians of immigration agree that the people who came over in the 19th century and the people who come over in the 20th and 21st all come with the intention of going home. Many end up staying here because they develop a family here, or it costs too much to go home, or some combination of things. Many end up liking America. But the first draw for so many people was the thought that they could come to America and make a good wage and then go home to the places they really cared about and buy more acres there, build a better house. And, in fact, lots of immigrants did do that, did go home, and continue to do that. So in the 19th century, close to 50% of all Italian immigrants go home. 15 to 20% of Eastern European Jews go home. And that, in some years, close to 50% of English immigrants went home in the 19th century. So this is a pretty widespread pattern of return migration. And today, looking at modern immigrants as a group, 20 to 40% of all immigrants go home.
Mm-hmm. And maybe more then and now would if they could.
Yeah, I think exactly. When you look at the letters and diaries, there's such a sense of longing that pervades the records they've left behind. And when I went to interview both immigrants living in America now and immigrants who had returned to Mexico, most people said, yeah, I came here with every intention of going back home.
I wonder if you could, let's see, this is, I think it's page 171. You could read the story of someone. You have most of a chapter here. Well, it is a full chapter. Immigrants and the Dream of Return.
Yeah.
And a lot of them find that it is a dream. It doesn't come true. You can't go home again. There's not only distance, but there's time that passes. So it's paragraph starting countless immigrants. It's the story
sure.
of Emma Planinsek.
Yeah, Emma Planinsek, who migrated from Slovenia in 1921, revisited her native village after many years. I was home again, visiting and speaking endlessly with people who were part of my past, but at the same time realizing with each passing day that I was no longer tied to my homeland as I had imagined. My heart, which had carried the weight of loneliness for four decades, suddenly was lightened and relieved from fantasies of what might have been. It was evident how much Dribolgi had changed, how much I had changed, and how impossible it was to go back in time and expect everything to be the way I had left it. And she said actually going home cured her of her homesickness because she realized it was no longer there.
And
home was no longer there.
Especially as the technology, you know, the railroad and such, it became easier to get back home. More people did it and had similar experience, right?
Yeah. You get, at the end of the 19th century, people able to cross the continent in trains and train cars when they had originally gone from the east to the west in covered wagons. Likewise, they can use transatlantic steamships to go home relatively quickly and relatively inexpensively. And what a lot of people find when they make this return is they've been dreaming of a place, imagining it's just as they left it, untouched by time. They come back and people have died, people have moved on, new buildings have come up, old buildings have come down. Nothing's as it seems. And I think this is where homesickness and nostalgia kind of take on new meanings. As I mentioned before, nostalgia was the traditional word for acute homesickness, and it meant you were longing for a place. A lot of people start going back to the places they've missed in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and they find those places no longer exist. And I think it's around then that nostalgia begins to take on its new meaning, which is longing for a lost time rather than a lost place, in part because people figure out that's what they've been missing, and that home is somehow unrecoverable, that it's back in the past.
I wonder if you, of course, you focus in this book on American homesickness.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you've studied other cultures with regard to homesickness. America is an interesting case study because we have this national mythology of the restless, the rugged individual, and we have this reputation as being restless. In fact, we've, I think, been criticized for that as well.
Yeah.
But I don't know if there are cultural differences in homesickness.
Yeah, actually, the first article I ever read was the one you mentioned by Jean Starobinsky in 1966. And he's just talking about French and Swiss soldiers who are stricken with the disease in the 1600s and 1700s. And I had read his article in grad school and thought it was fascinating because there were a few Swiss soldiers dying of homesickness. And I thought, well, that could never happen in America because we have become accustomed to mobility. So I was very surprised to find that, in fact, Americans were just as susceptible to the disease as the Swiss. But while Americans shared qualities with some Europeans, there was this ongoing debate in the medical literature and psychological literature about who was most likely to be homesick. So the Swiss were the first case, and I think it was because a lot of young Swiss men in the 1600s and 1700s were going off and fighting as mercenaries in other armies, so they were getting displaced. And so they seemed particularly prone to the condition. On the other hand, some claimed the English never felt homesick because they were a nation that was used to trade and colonization. I don't think that's probably true, but that was the national stereotype. It seemed a pretty pervasive condition among the French, and in fact, there's some interesting research being done on that right now. So I think it takes on different, it has different characteristics in different cultures, and not everybody necessarily treats it with the same disdain that Americans do today. Mm-hmm. I think in some places it's more acceptable to admit you miss home than it is in America. But you do find across Western Europe, as nations are modernizing, as economies are becoming more global, that lots of people around the world are experiencing these same feelings.
And I'm interested especially in this idea of this word, which can't be totally translated into English. It's saudades. It's a Portuguese word.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia definition, a deep emotional state of nostalgic or profound melancholic longing for an absent something or someone that one loves. So that's very ingrained in Portuguese and Brazilian culture, you know, for one example. I guess that could illustrate as well that this feeling is universal.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a whole debate among historians of emotion of, you know, you may find similar words, and is it the same emotion, or does the fact that the words are embedded in a different language, in a different culture, mean it's something slightly different? And I don't think there's any definitive way to answer if it's the same emotion or not. But we do know that leaving home has caused pain. It may take on different forms and have different meanings. But whether it's the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey, or medieval voyagers far from home, there are references to people experiencing a yearning desire to be back where they started.
By the way, in Brazil, Day of Saudade is the 30th of January, so that's coming up this week. So just if you want to celebrate that. So we're going to take another break, and we'll be back with Susan Matt, who's author of Homesickness and American History. In our final segment, I want to get into recounting. There's a very impactful story, Susan, I'll have you tell this, in the book of a slave woman who actually killed herself. There's a belief prevalent, I guess, at the time that's the only way you could get back.
Right.
Your soul would go back. So we'll talk about that and Indian migration and some other things as we wrap up this topic for today following the break.
Native tribes have relied on the bounty of Alaska's rivers for thousands of years and fear that new mines upstream in Canada could end their way of life.
The river is really important. Industry comes and goes, but a river, by golly, once you destroy it, it's gone. You can't bring it back.
The Quest for Gold and Wild Alaskan Rivers. I'm Steve Curwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tuesday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread in Logan. Open for breakfast Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. and Saturdays at 8 a.m., offering a selection of French pastries and a variety of sweet and savory menu items. Details at crumbbrothers.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking about homesickness. The book is Homesickness in American History. It's out from Oxford University Press. Susan Matt is the author. She is Presidential Distinguished Professor of History at Weber State University and Chair of the History Department there. We're talking about this feeling I think we've all had, but in our culture, in our times, homesickness is dismissed. It's a sign of immaturity. It's what children feel at summer camp. It's a very real emotion, however. And Susan Matt says we need to look at it. And I suppose you would say, Susan Matt, we shouldn't repress it. What should we do with this if we feel it?
Well, I think it would be a good thing for Americans to admit they have it, so that people who are moving and uprooted don't feel so alone in their sadness and displacement. Because I think it can be a very isolating experience to feel that you're the only person who's ever felt homesick, when in fact it's a very American thing to be homesick, and that it's been with us since the founding of the colonies. And so I think it would be a much healthier thing if we admitted that mobility has costs. It also brings opportunities and advantages, but it certainly has takes an emotional toll.
I'd like to go back to your example. You and your husband decide you want to come out west. So you come out to Utah, been here 16 years. So what would you suggest? What, I mean, you'd put an investment into your new place, I imagine? You don't just live apart. That would probably help.
Yeah, and that's certainly the advice people get, is throw yourself into your new community. The old advice used to be don't call home. That would toughen you up. I'm not sure I see much point in that. I think it's part of our national obsession of being independent and not ever showing neediness that you're not supposed to admit you have these emotions. So while the old advice was don't call home, I don't see why it would hurt, but you also want to invest in the new place and develop a new set of connections as well. And I think our modern age actually accommodates that pretty well, that you can do both.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about some of the dark side of this idea of homesickness, starting with slavery. Of course, these are people who were forcibly brought to a new country. And I was very interested to learn about this belief, at least early on. And there's a African-American woman who digs a hole, right? And she eviscerates herself. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so there was an article that appeared in the 1730 in the Boston Gazette in 1733, the newspaper there, talking about a recent suicide, and it read, "A Negro woman at Salem, determined to go into her own country, as she called it, took a bottle of rum and two biscuits and carried them into the burying place there, where she dug a hole and covered them, and then took a knife and cut her belly so much that her guts came out. Her wound was sewed up, but she died a day or two afterwards." And she was acting on a belief that was widespread among African slaves and even among their children who were born in America, that upon death, you would be reincarnated and liberated and back in Africa. So you see, throughout the whole course of the enslavement process, when people are in slave ships, they're often jumping overboard and committing suicide, believing that they'll be brought back to life and in freedom in Africa upon death. And once people are here, some people kill themselves in slavery. There are lots of accounts all across the East Coast of people doing this. I also found accounts of people who hope to make the journey back alive. And so there are these really heartbreaking accounts, heartbreaking because we know they weren't successful attempts, of people, you know, trying to paddle a canoe from South Carolina across the Atlantic Ocean, or people trying to board ships in the hope that they would take them back to Africa. Lots of ads in colonial newspaper talked about people intending to go home and be on the lookout for this runaway slave because he's trying to get back. So if for the people who had the least control over their migrations, their forced migrations, homesickness was particularly acute, because not only were you missing people, but you had no control. control. And I'm not saying that's the only emotion slaves felt. They surely felt anger and injustice and a whole host of other feelings. But homesickness was certainly a powerful feeling.
Just have a couple minutes left. I'd like to end with this. There's a very interesting picture. It's on page 116, and it's an Indian boy who's plowing, and there's a cloud, one of those thought clouds, and he's remembering his former life with teepees and such.
It's an illustration from the Carlisle Indian School's magazine from 1918, and the Carlisle Indian School was established in the 19th century by Richard Henry Pratt, who had the idea that if you could take Native Americans away from their tribes and educate them in these boarding schools, you could teach them how to be individualistic Americans who would be modern and not so tied to a particular piece of land, but integrated into the American scene. And so the illustration conveys how Colonel Pratt and his colleagues thought this process should look, where you'd have a Native young man plowing fields as a white American would, but still kind of fondly recollecting on the life he'd left behind, but not going back to it. Mm-hmm. And that was the hope of so many boarding schools. And those boarding schools were just really quite emotionally grueling experiences for so many Native young people who, in their memoirs and letters, talk again and again of just often going against their will. Everybody was crying because they wanted to go home. But once they go home, they don't quite fit in because they have a different sense of the world. They have a different education and different expectations, and they too feel caught between two societies.
We'll end with a comment from Steve in Arizona, who joins us on our email. He says, a comment, not a question. 7 or 8 years ago, as a middle-aged man, I immigrated, quote-unquote, from the East Coast to Arizona border with Utah. At first, the culture, big pickup trucks and belt buckles, casinos, cowboy hats and boots, seemed alien and exotic, and the arid landscape, particularly in the blazing heat of the summer, was quite shocking. No longer. I am quite accustomed to it and enjoy it now, though I have managed to create a small simulacrum of Connecticut on 2 acres surrounding the house where I live. So adapted have I become that now when I visit the East, it is the lush green verdure of the landscape which shocks the eyes. Still, I don't think I will ever feel fully home in the West, as I surely would have had I come at a younger age, and I will always take comfort in visits, quote-unquote, home. So that's interesting. I wonder if any of that resonates with you, Susan, Matt, especially I want to follow up on this idea of he feels like he would have become better accustomed perhaps if he'd come as a younger man.
Yeah, and I think the longer you're in a place, the more years you have, you realize that you've lived longer often in the new home than the one you've been calling home. That's certainly the case for me, that I've lived longer in Ogden than I've lived any place else in my life. So that certainly is making it more home-like with every passing year.
And interesting, he's created small Connecticut on 2 acres surrounding his house. That's something we all do, I think.
Yeah, you find the artifacts that bring comfort and the people and the sounds and recreate home. And I think we've all become pretty good at that as Americans.
Well, thanks for that, Steve. And thanks to you, Susan Matt. Susan Matt is Presidential Distinguished Professor of History at Weber State University, author of several works, including the one we talked about today, Homesickness and American History. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And join us, of course, tomorrow for Access Utah. We're going to take a look at the Sundance Film Festival. Thanks for joining me today as well.
Commentator Gina Wickwar.
In her essay in Monday's Wall Street Journal, Lenore Skenazy describes her frustration about giving parties where guests don't show up, specifically parties whose invited guests, even though they've RSVP'd, fail to appear. In It's My Party and I'll Cry Havoc If You Don't Show, Skenazy goes through the usual excuses given by the penitent would-be guest. I've suddenly come down with a terrible cold. Raucous coughing in background. The baby's come down with colic and we can't leave her with a sitter. Squalid and hiccuping in background. I've suddenly realized I have a million things to do, and hey, I hope you won't mind. Hostess minds terribly. Skenazy describes a friend's party where 50 people were invited and accepted, and only 8 showed. Another was a friend's wine tasting for 8, and only 3 appeared, and on and on. She admits that some of her friends have a much less, quote, scorched earth attitude toward party no-shows, unquote. They figure about a third of their invitees will not make it, whether they've RSVP'd or not. Skenazy, however, is more like me. When I plan a party, it is an event. I go to a lot of trouble, and I expect, short of a life-threatening illness, my guests to be there when they've said they would be. If it's a sit-down dinner, I do a lot of shopping and food preparation. I clean the house, no small feat, set and decorate the table and make sure everything is perfect for my guests. If it's a potluck, I prepare the main dish, clean the house and yard, decorate, and set out the patio tables if it's summer, and again, try to make everything perfect. So when people begin calling early in the morning of the party and start backing out, I am personally outraged, despite my murmured words of sympathy. If I really had guts, I'd ask the person if she'd cared to pay for the extra pound and a half of prime rib I had ordered for her and her husband's dinner, or ask her to send her spouse over with the tuna casserole she'd signed up for the potluck dinner. But I don't. Instead, I seethe and brood over the perceived slights as if they were meant personally. They aren't, of course. Most of our friends are truly decent and have planned on coming to the party, the dinner, or the potluck cookout. It's just something got in their way, something unavoidable, and even I need to forgive them. But wait, you say. What about those quasi-friends, the ones who back out of your party at the last minute because they just got an invite to a gathering that's more exciting and has more cachet? Well, I say good riddance to them and have happily scratched them off my dinner party potluck guest list. It's too bad, too, because they really don't know the fun and enjoyment they're missing. It's taken most of a lifetime, but after all these years, I finally realize that it's their problem, not mine. This is Gina Wickwar.
Utah Public Radio is looking for a business manager. The successful candidate for this full-time USU benefited position is responsible for processing all of the financial activities for UPR and reports directly to UPR's general manager. Among other minimum qualifications, at least 2 years of full-time accounting experience is required. For detailed information on this position and how you can join the UPR team, go to upr.org and click on the About Us tab and go to Careers.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we bring you funky techno and tribal beats, cool combinations of electronic effects with traditional melodies heard in the clubs and lounges of Europe, Africa, Asia, and Australia.
One day, one woman asked him, what do you to survive?
I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Global Groove, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.
And thank you for listening to Access Utah today on Utah Public Radio, a service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. Stay tuned for Living on Earth coming up next every Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock here on Utah Public Radio.